We have already devoted several evenings to the discussion of the various basic septenaries which constitute the archetype or framework of universal procedure. And it is quite fitting that we should consider among these septenaries the great structure of man's religious conviction. Antiquity regarded religion rather differently from the modern world. We recognize the gradual rise of powerful sectarian groups, and these have had a tendency to obscure man's concept of total faith or of complete religion. In each of the septenaries that we have traced, we have made special emphasis on the fact that these septenaries emerge from their own root, or from the first major division in each of the classifications. Thus, for example, we pointed out that the development of races takes place within the first race, that the first race never vanishes or disappears from the earth, but is gradually apparently absorbed into the great racial strain and the great racial motion, and ultimately, at the end of the cycle of evolution, reemerges again in its own totality, so that the seven races are the growth of one race unfolding to experience the total unity of itself. Now, in the same way, religion begins as a total concept. It begins as one faith, one great order of belief. And what we call religions are not separate institutions arising at various times and under various conditions. They're actually the unfoldment of the great religion archetype, which is given to man as part of his own essential nature. Thus, man's spiritual unfoldment is under the keeping of a law, of a pattern. And this pattern remains available to him, though perhaps obscured in some ages, throughout the total need span, which exists from the beginning to the full revelation of his own nature. The purpose of religion is not to impose doctrine upon man, but to release truth through man. It is not the end of faith that men should actually come to accept one religion as finally superior to another, but to accept the fact that religion per se is the sum of all its parts, and that the great religious mystery, which deals with the redemption and restoration of human consciousness, is a total mystery. Obviously, this total mystery is not obvious to us, because we are not total creatures. We are not yet in full possession of our own faculties, powers, and perceptions. Therefore, having a dimness in our own sight, we see as through a glass darkly. But ultimately, this great revelation of world faith, a revelation indistinguishable in its substance from world law and world truth, will have its perfect work and will unfold to the creatures which it has fashioned for the purpose of its own development. In ancient times, religious institutions were termed mysteries. The mystery system, as it was anciently practiced, has virtually disappeared from our world. There are vestiges of it in Asia and the Near East, but it is comparatively unknown to Western man. The mystery system stands for at least two major lines of thought. Those sacred institutions which were developed as state religions, arising with a people, and more or less directing that people's career, its culture, its morality, its ethics. These institutions were racial and national religions. Very often, these religions were limited even to a single area or community. Therefore, there were religions which flourished only in certain cities or towns where the entire population recognized a certain faith, a certain institution, which had been bestowed upon them at the beginning of their history, and which had continued to guide and guard their destinies through the long unfoldment of their peoples. Our early Amerindian religious beliefs fell under this heading. The tribes could not and did not develop sectarianism. They had perhaps several deities, but there was no sense that these deities were in conflict, nor did these deities give rise to separate religious institutions. They gave rise only to certain divisions within the total religious picture. We have very little knowledge of the religious state of man prior to the great periods of enlightenment, which go back as far as the second millennium B.C. Before that time, our records are too insecure for dogmatizing. But we do know that 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago, and even somewhat longer, great religious institutions existed. That these institutions occupied the positions of leadership in the total field of the people. Thus, the mystery school was also the college. It was the seminary for the education of the priesthood. It was the hospital and the clinic. It combined within itself practically all of the essential functions of knowledge. And all knowledge was its province. These institutions accepted candidates. Candidates usually selected for their personal ability and for the integrity of their character. These were variously tested, tried, and proven. And after a thorough examination, far more complete than anything we could pass today, these candidates were accepted into the sacred schools. And in these schools, they were given their share or their participation in the common knowledge of their people, the worship of their gods, and the arts and sciences cultivated by that race or group. Those who received such instruction and were duly graduated were themselves persons of extraordinary authority in their societies, regarded, venerated, applauded, and held as semi-divine persons. All of these fragments we know. Earlier than this, we have an inkling of the general concept. This concept goes back to the primitive, tribal, and brood family custom of initiating the adolescent into the tribe or into the social group to which he belonged. Citizenship was not conferred by birth, but by initiation into the tribal rites. As these tribal rites became more complicated and the tribe gave place to the civilization, the culture, the state, these rituals were further amplified until they became a symbolical means of attaining maturity. The individual who passed these mysteries successfully was the true citizen. He was the one empowered to represent his people, to vote in the common meetings and elections of his tribe or people. He must have this knowledge. He must have this internal participation in the deeper values of the group, or else he was not regarded as eligible to sit in the council of mature persons and legislate the future of his group, of his nation or tribe. Now, these physical factors arose apparently instinctively in man. We do not know where they began or how, but we do know that from the beginning they were universally followed. That peoples in no physical contact with each other and of most remote origin held these ideas as common truth. Thus, we must assume that these institutions, or at least the instincts which produced them, were part of man's own internal life. They were not imposed upon him, they emerged from him, meeting needs which he himself had come to recognize, and fulfilling instincts which he himself naturally expressed in his conduct. Now, wherever we have such a pattern unfolding, we know this pattern must have its root in some adequate cause. Nothing from nothing comes. And in this world, changes which occur, pressures which are exerted, bear witness to causes or to circumstances equal in intensity with themselves. Thus, we have another possible meaning for the term mystery school. It represents an invisible order of religion. It represents the psychic, spiritual, psychological cause of the religious instinct. It is itself invisible, like the soul of man. But like the soul, it produces visible consequences. And this intangible, from which flow tangible and obvious results or effects, cannot be regarded as less than the effects which it produces. Thus, the tremendous rise of religion in the objective life of man bears witness to the subjective religious fact as part of the universal pattern of existence and of universal law. In the ancient writings and the old teachings about these things, therefore, we see or learn that the religious instinct or the religious concept perhaps can be most easily traced through the unfoldment of human racial evolution or the racial development and structure of things. In the ancient mystical writings of the Jewish people, we are told that Adam went to school before the fall. We are therefore, from this symbolism, to observe that man, prior to his descent into a material state, while still during the Polarian and Hyperborean epochs, still visibly and physically a species rather than a race. A group of beings suspended above the earth or functioning through sensitized fields of energy, as we previously have described. That these beings, though not aware and not objectively polarized on a material level, still retain their spiritual contact with the great invisible universe around them. In this spiritual state, in this condition of internalization, they were under the instruction and direction of the hierarchs, or the great orders of beings, with whom they were still in kind of contact. And in the old writings we often learn or hear that in these ancient times man, or the pre-Adamite creature, had an internal sharing in the great creative process of the hierarchies. Now the hierarchies are the great orders of beings transcending man and administrating the world under the direction and power of the Logoi, or the great gods. These hierarchies are therefore orders of beings between gods and men, orders whom the Greeks call the heroes, the demigods, or the superhuman beings, the mysterious and wonderful teachers who walk the earth in the dawn of things. These hierarchs probably did not teach in the sense of human souls or beings sitting about and listening to them. The teachment was by way of man's internal contact with the entire order of creation. Thus man could observe the splendor of the spheres and realize that these were not merely globes floating in space or circling the sovereign altar of the sun, but that these were living beings, that these were indeed great angels, planetary or star spirits, and that this whole creation was full of life, full of radiant beings, serving, unfolding the various potencies and potentials which constitute the universe. Man, having this internal vision, could not be ignorant. He therefore could have no unreasonable doubts about providence. In fact, perhaps he could not even be aware of providence. He could not know good or evil. He could only adore that which was, or recognize the sovereignty of things known. And about things known, there is no confusion. There is no question, no inconsistency, and no conflict. It is about things not known or not generally obvious that we have difference of opinion. Thus, in this period, where it is said in the ancient Kabbalistic writings that human beings went to school in the University of the Angels, man lived in the presence of causal agencies, revered them, understood them, and accepted them. Therefore, he lived in an experience of participation in a universe of life. He existed in a participation in the total conscious existence of space, as though indeed the heavens opened and the magnificent celestial choirs of Milton were known to him and experienced by him. When, through what has been symbolically referred to as the fall of man, the human being descended into a state of obscuration, in which his internal faculties were darkened, and his knowledge of causes no longer gave him the vital facts of his own origin and destiny, he became, so to say, an orphan, a blinded creature, who, as he lost sight of the roots and substances of universal existence, found in their place the unfolding objective universe of matter. By degrees, his sensitivities to the material environment increased. And as these increased, even the dreams and memories of ancient things were submerged. And he became the victim of his own eyes, of his own sensory perceptions, of his own cognitional faculties. And by slow stages, he oriented himself in a material world and saw around him many things, within him very little. Yet these things which he had known could not cease. His own internal sharing at the beginning of things and in the total inner of himself, his sharing of this vast universe of fact, this absolute reality, this did not die because nothing dies. Things are only obscured or seem to retire into the deep recesses and fastnesses of unconscious storehouses. But out of these roots, even primitive man had certain kinds of recollections. Recollections that were only available to him in dreams, in visions, and in his mystical trances and contemplations. He discovered, however, that if he became very quiet, if he became completely detached from the objective interests and concerns that were increasing around him and within him, he still could feel the strange impress of the great seal of universal reality. This is the seal that Bemi calls the signatarum rerum, the great signature of things, the great impression, the archetypal reality was still somewhere within himself, but it only came out to him in symbols, in fragmentary visions and in dreams and in distorted pictures, but still this pressure was there. And it was this pressure which gradually forced man to create, to objectify with himself the symbolism of his internal conviction. Thus man objectively, materially, began to build the structure of his faith. He built it from his own impulses, his own instincts, and his own needs. And there is no question in the world that Ingersoll was in part right when he said that an honest God is the noblest work of man. That man actually created his own gods. He created his own angels and devils. He created the numerous and various sectarianisms which have arisen in his world. But this is only part of the story. Just as primitive mankind first projected from itself the strange, distorted bodies which it was later to occupy, and only when these bodies, rising from the primary eros, or slime of progenital matter, when these bodies reached a certain degree of growth, they were ensouled. And it is the same with the strange mystery of religion. When the symbols and the primitive rites and the crude worships of man gradually refined, gradually took upon themselves an integration of moral and ethical significance, these bodies became ensouled by the great descending order of hierarchs. Thus, in each case, a religion is born. It is born when a belief is ensouled, just as man is born when a body is ensouled. Thus, as man was building upward his dream, a dream which might not have been very different from the Tower of Babel, at the same time, from the invisible world, the great archetypal pattern was also flowing into manifestation. And the union of the archetype with an appropriate form represented an ensoulment, or a coming into life. And at various stages down through the great descent of human experience, the primary and primitive religious instincts of man have gradually led to ensoulments. in which, through one mystery or another, faiths have suddenly become vital, have suddenly ceased to be merely human accumulations, and have received into and upon themselves the stamp of a divine destiny. All faiths were not ensouled. Some were too imperfect and died in limbo. Others had but a brief and passing existence. But gradually out of the ruins of some and the struggles of others, there have emerged the great instruments or vehicles in which the power of the hierarchies ultimately came to be embodied, producing religious experience, religious differentiation, religious evolution, and ultimately to produce, as in the race, the final culmination of embodiment, which is the restoration of the absolute identity of life. Now, this problem is long and arduous and difficult, and it does not to serve our purposes particularly well to devote too much in time and attention to it. But I think we should realize that the human being, for example, does the same thing in his daily living. Perhaps on religious and philosophical matters he is a little dim. He is not quite sure how important these things are to him. He is exposed to beliefs constantly. He is nominally associated with beliefs. But in his growth, there is a time when all his believing, all his seeking, all his searching, all his scattered but valuable convictions are brought together and ensouled by one purpose. Suddenly, what he terms religion becomes a vital living force, binding together all of these elements and becoming a dynamic in his life. This shift from a static to a dynamic spiritual position is really the ensoulment of the religious conviction of the individual. Now, how and when does this occur? As in the universe, it is almost a perpetual process of occurrence. It occurs in many levels according to the spiritual need of the individual. But on every level, there is the seeking and the finding, and there is finally orientation as the result of conviction becoming dynamic, taking a central place in the life and assuming leadership. Thus, wherever conviction becomes the leader, wherever faith achieves its victory over doubt, wherever the individual moves into some position in which spiritual values become leaders, become dynamics in his character and in his conduct, then he may be said to have brought a union between religion as a universal mystery and religious symbolism as a series of personal experiences. Obviously, as man evolves and produces more adequate instruments, these ensoulments become more vital, more universal, more profound, more lasting, more secure, and certainly more comforting and inspiring. But on each level, man ensouls his general conviction with the level of dynamic available to him. Just as in listening to words, each of us bestows upon the word the meaning which is the total of our own knowledge at that particular time. And so we keep on bestowing. And this bestowing upon things of something of ourselves is part of the mystery of religion. And that is why individuals belonging to different religions may have, without realizing it, the same convictions. And why those belonging to the same religion may have, without realizing it, different convictions. Because they can secure from it only that which they can bestow upon it from the resources coming into expression from within themselves. Thus, ensoulment is a motion of energy from within the individual, which is forever taking over and becoming dominant in the patterns which man creates. Now, in the Eastern philosophies, there was the belief that at a very remote time, as soon as the great polar cap began to crystallize, in the very beginning of the Earth's solidification, the rotation of the Earth at the poles was less rapid than at the equator. And as a result of that, the crystallization began at the polar caps and moved slowly toward the equatorial band. As the first solid areas appeared at the very beginning of the Hyperborean era, it is said that the polar cap became the imperishable island. And from this imperishable island, life moved to all other parts of the planet. The reason being, of course, that the first area capable of sustaining life naturally became the first area to receive and disseminate life. And as this life evolved, it spread following the solidifying processes and moving as atmospheric conditions and the state of the Earth made possible along the great lines leading downward from the polar caps. In this time also it is said that the gods, or the great orders of hierarchs, made their immediate connection with the Earth and bestowed upon it the shadow of the great world mountain, Meru, the abode of the gods. The old astronomers tell us that Meru was actually located in the subtle energy fields far above the surface of the Earth, in the great northern polar axial point of the planet, far above all physical things. And that essentially Meru, or the city of the gods, remains there, but that its shadow or projection finally descended into the newly prepared Earth. And here at the polar cap, or in the imperishable island, all of the vast mechanism involved in the creation of a habitable world and the inhabitants of that world all flowed from this center. Thus life began here, nations began here, continents began, and this one imperishable island also became the root and seat of man's spiritual empire. For it was here, according to the ancients, that the city of the gods was built, and here that the divine government took over. Now this divine government was not an autocracy as we know it. It was simply the great administrative structure of universal law. We think of religion today as something different from universal administration, but actually there is no essential difference. For it is the duty of the leader, whether spiritual or from the standpoint of intellectual or philosophical conduct, it is the duty of the leader to bring the law. The great teacher is the law revealer. And as man does not realize that this is a re-revelation, he thinks of the great leader as the law giver. The leader does not give the law, he is the channel or instrument for its restatement in some sphere of life or experience. In this great order of things, therefore, the Trans-Himalayan school, located on the ancient site of the polar cap, which because of many motions of the Earth is no longer located directly beneath the physical pole of the planet. This tremendous center of energy, this center for the releasing of the spiritual laws by which the lives of all things are governed. This center was set up as the primary religious focus of mankind. All religion known to man comes from there. All religion is an unfoldment or a revelation of the realities that are associated with this great center. Now, the difference between perhaps a religion and a science lies principally in the way in which knowledge creates an impact upon the life of the person. The scientist knows the law. The philosopher understands the law. The religionist experiences the law. Therefore, religion must be grounded in the internal experience of realities. This internal experience means that the channel must be through the person, coming from his own internal and experienced and known by himself before it can flow from him into environmental manifestation or existence. Religion is therefore a living impact. It is not a contemplative approach. It is a participation in a certain valid spiritual experience. Thus, religion has always taught, primarily as one of its great premises, this immediate experience of God, experience of the value and power of things. Now, the Greeks in their mythologies, and the Egyptians, and the Asiatics also, have shown us under fable and legend, under symbol and myth, the story of the divine power moving into objectivity. For reasons that are absolutely valid in the experience of man, these powers were personified or individualized or symbolized as beings. This does not necessarily mean that these powers were without being, but their being in substance was totally different from man's symbolical effort to depict that being. Zeus in nature certainly did not resemble the statue by Phidias, nor could we say that the true Brahma is identical with the great stone face in the caves of Elephanta in the harbor of Bombay. These are representations, mnemonic symbols, asking to be understood, presenting the individual with a challenge, attempting to compel in him an attentiveness or a contemplation of principles through their appropriate or at least glorious forms. Thus we find in the Greek mythology that the Olympian gods upon their mountain became the rulers of the world. These 12 gods, again the 12 aces of Scandinavia, and in various parts of the world, similar figures, the world mountain, the New Jerusalem upon a mountain. Wonderful emblems and figures of the great mountain, and our natural religious inclination, as indicated in the Bible, where we are reminded that we lift up our eyes unto the hills from whence cometh our help. This raising of the consciousness toward the high place has some strange symbolic significance out of recollection or part remembrance, the symbolism of the great hierarchy, the great order of beings dwelling upon the mystical mountain in the center of the world, the crest and summit of which rises above the clouds and is invisible to mortals. This is the Olympian hill. This is the great triple helicon of Parnassus, where Apollo and his muses dwelt together. So in the ancient times, we are told that the gods, representing the divine powers, incarnate in their most natural and available forms precipitated themselves out of their own states and became the guardians, leaders, and guides of humanity. And at that time also, the ancient records tell us that beings from other planets, elders, the patriarchs of other worlds, the lunar and solar deities, and many others, came and mingled with mankind and established within man, within human society, the great patriarchal orders, which were later to become the shepherd guardians of infant humanity. These ancient orders being the orders of the psychopomps, or the herders of souls, the shepherd kings of ancient religious writings. This school of the adepts must follow, therefore, the general laws governing all such mysteries in nature. Religion as fact consists of first a magnificent total fact, which becomes manifested as a septenary. And as the great blazing septenary of spiritual truth radiated gradually into manifestation, we see there truth or reality broken up into seven parts, which were known as the seven sacred arts, the seven sacred branches of learning. Now the truth of philosophy broke into the seven great branches of philosophy, which are still recognized. The truths of science broke into the seven sciences. The truths of architecture broke into the seven orders. The truths of sound broke into the mysterious scale with its octaves and its tones and its half tones. All these things were lawfully done because on every level and in every pattern the same great principles were asserting themselves. Thus religion is given to man as seven rays or seven powers of light. These seven powers being aimed at and being equal to the task which man's spiritual need reveals. Thus we have in the concept of religion seven cardinal virtues, or the seven good things. And these are the remedies for the seven deadly sins, which are the seven things which are not good. It would follow also that religions would break into manifestation as great patterns in connection with and harmoniously with races. And it is also certain that with each root race, a root religious principle is introduced, because at the beginning of each great cycle of evolution, it is necessary, as the Hindu tells us, for the deity Vishnu to take upon himself the embodiment and to descend into the ocean of time to rescue the Vedas. That is, to restore the law which had been stolen away by ignorance, crystallization, and death. Thus, in each era, in each great epoch, it is necessary for the law to be restored. And in this restoration, the great school moves into manifestation in an orderly and proper manner. And this manifestation we outwardly regard as the coming of a great teacher, but inwardly it is the coming of a reality through man. First through archetypal human beings, through advanced individuals, and later disseminated from and by them, becoming the common property of a collective group. Now another thing that we have to bear in mind is that this great stream of religion has gone back probably as far as the first differentiation of the human being, and therefore better than 35 million years. And that our own great Aryan faith goes back not less than a million years. And that the great Atlantean religious pattern goes back from 4 to 5 million years. Now we cannot know or conceive of a religion that is that old. In the study of comparative religion, if you take it up seriously, you will discover, however, that records, though not of this age, have been formulated by which we have attempted to distinguish the primary streams of religious descent. For example, one of the great streams is serpent worship. Now, serpent worship has gone through innumerable vicissitudes, but serpent worship in some form, the faith of the Ophites, goes back to a very, very remote time. Another is fire worship, the worship of primordial fire. Another is worship of generation, the worship of the reproductive process in nature. These great roots go far back, and they perhaps come nearer to telling us how these religious concepts descend. Because today, underneath the surface of our religion, these great primaries continue to exist. But we have so overshadowed them with symbolism and with a larger intellectual approach that we no longer recognize that these great basic symbols still lie at the roots of our believing. But the point that we want to particularly make is this. We say there are dead religions, that the religion of Egypt is dead. That is, the religion of classical Egypt. That the religion of Greece is dead. That many great faiths of long ago have vanished away. With these faiths have ceased the gods of Babylon and Chaldea. With these faiths have also vanished the deities of the Near East that were worshipped prior to the coming of the Muslim faith. Everywhere it seems as though old religions have died. Yet actually, no religion has died. Because every religion, having borne its fruit, this fruit ripened and the seed was perfected, and from the seed grew new faiths. But there is an unbroken descent of religion from the earliest experience that we know. And all the religions that we have today are the amplifications of those that are gone. Religions are not separate things, they are growths, they are evolutions, continually proceeding in nature. And any religion that we have today would have been deformed, or would have perhaps even failed to exist, had not some dead religion preceded it, supplying it with certain elements of belief essential to the continuity of things. I remember discussing some of these points with the Patriarch Athenagoras of the Greek Orthodox Church. He is the Ecumenical Patriarch, the head of the entire Eastern Church. And he pointed out the tremendous amount of religious symbols that we had derived directly from Egypt. How the great College of the Cardinals comes from the 72 scarlet-robed priests of the mysteries of Isis and Osiris. How the crozier, how the mitre, how the vestments, and how the rites, rituals, and sacraments all trace back to the great sacerdotal institutions of Egypt. Therefore, we are perpetuating today these things that we think are dead. For death means merely, in a term of psychological thought, a submerging. It is something that was upon the surface, sinking back, other things taking the foreground, and they in turn sinking back, until man gradually has within himself this vast storehouse of submerged values. And then, under the various pressures of existence, these submerged values begin to move back again under the principle of law of association or the conditioned reflex. These things are again available to man. Thus, religions do not die. They simply live on in other faiths. And this is true, of course, particularly of the great Atlantean and Aryan schools, which are still strongly represented among us. We mentioned in connection with the last evening's discussion, the seven laws of nature, that five laws are revealed to us and two are concealed. Therefore, that for two of the great laws of nature, we have symbolic substitutes, because these laws have not yet been perfected within our own natures. To a degree, this follows also in our religious pattern, because today we have many religions, but we have five great religious systems. These religious systems have descended to us to become living forces in our modern world. And these represent the spiritual availability which maintains and sustains the greater part of the civilized world. The lesser religions and beliefs are nearly always branches. They are further divisions within these groups themselves, or divisions caused by the commixture of two or more groups, usually in what you might term border culture zones, where peoples have been exposed to two or more religions with relatively equal influence. These culture zones may therefore produce compounding faiths or religions built up of more than one element. But we have five that are very powerful and that constitute the greater part of our religious life. One of these is Hinduism, another Buddhism, a third the religions and philosophies of China, the fourth Muslimism, and the fifth Judeo-Christianity. These constitute the great religious structures of our world. And in some mysterious way, they seem to fulfill the old pattern. For into these, to make them possible, has flowed a tremendous amount of ancient tradition. They are the living witnesses to all that has gone before. Now, some religions are a little ashamed of their own inheritance. They seem to feel that their importance lies upon their isolation, that they must try to kill out or conceal the fact that they have a common spiritual indebtedness. To my mind, this has always been a mistake, because it seems it's a deliberate effort at isolation. And in so doing, the individual, by separating himself voluntarily from the great pattern, closes his eyes and his consciousness to the wholeness of things, and must therefore be penalized by having a fragmentary spiritual existence. This arises from all vestiges of intolerance and from all comparison, and from this great problem so expressed by in the story of the Pharisees, in which the individual says, "I am holier than thou." Actually, all of these faiths are to a measure mutually interdependent, that they have tremendous inter-spiritual integrities. They have all communicated and transmitted vastly vital messages, and they continue to lead and to guard the peoples of the world. This leaves us two divisions which have not yet been clarified, and I think that this clarification lies very largely in the growth or unfoldment of the future state of man. Every great religion in the world has in some degree or in some way anticipated a future dispensation yet to come, a way of life not yet perfect, which is to be fulfilled by some kind either of an avatar or of an embodiment of a superior being, or by means of an achievement by man himself which becomes equivalent to his awakening or his salvation through the increased spiritual availability of truth to himself. Thus, the sixth and seventh religions have not yet been fashioned because man himself has not yet perfected them. There is a feeling that many have, and perhaps it is not an unwise feeling, that future religious differentiation within this great racial cycle is in some way dependent upon the rise of the newest instrument that we have in knowledge, namely science. That although today perhaps religion and science are a little better than incompatible in practice, that religion in the future is most likely to arise from the scientific level. Something is happening and will continue to happen. The toga, or the torch, which must be passed on, is gradually going to be moved into the keeping of a new dimension of consciousness arising from scientific penetration of the unknown. Today we have no very clear vestige of what this is going to be, except perhaps that we know that if man seeks long enough and far enough in any direction, he is going to find only one thing, and that is the mystery of reality. If he continues doggedly in his pursuit of the unknown, he must ultimately attain that which may be known. And whichever way he turns, however he may seek, he will always come in the end to the final thing, and that is the realization of universal consciousness. There is nothing else that can solve any problem. So it's quite possible that in the centuries that lie ahead, what we call science will gradually be metamorphosed into a great religious revelation. And that when this occurs, in the fullness of time, the struggle between faith and knowledge will no longer continue. The seventh division of the religious life of a people, the seventh religion, must then naturally arise from that which precedes it. And in this case, as always, the seventh must be the fulfillment of the first, where that which is in the beginning shall be in the end. The first shall be last, says the scripture, and this particularly relates to the mystery of spiritual understanding. The religion which began, which died by being submerged into the mystery of creeds, is the great unity which must ultimately emerge. So as unity leads first to diversity, and then diversity ultimately leads back to unity, so the seventh religion of a cycle is the gradual restatement of the total picture. In the beginning there is one, and in the end there is an all that becomes one. So those who are laboring toward this great religious inter-understanding are definitely laboring toward the future. They are what the medieval mystics call the sons of towardness. They are laboring to the fulfillment of an instinct, namely this instinct that all religion is one great experience, and that until we appreciate it as such, we can never fully understand it.